the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true. I love you.
Thank you, Doc. Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. That was Sarita singing Sonny and Frank Sinatra sing. Here's Johnny, the night he hosted The Tonight Show. Welcome to John Barber's World, headquartered right here in Las Vegas, Nevada. I hope I'm not being a little premature with this announcement, but I wanted to say this because some of you may want to make travel plans to Olney College in Illinois. Professor David Denton is putting on what I think is going to be the very best JFK conference in history, and probably the last one. The dates are April 4th through the 7th. I am staying one extra day, the 8th, because a number of the attendees have asked to see the American media and the second assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Of course, I'll be speaking there primarily about the Garrison Files. The first one we released recently was about Clay Shaw. The next one is about Lee Harvey Oswald and his journal. But there are many speakers a whole lot more effective than I am. One of them is Christopher Fulton, the author of The Inheritance. It's an incredible personal story. And an even more incredible personal story is the story of James Jenkins, the young intern who was called in to assist in the autopsy of President John Kennedy. He and William Matson Law wrote At the Cold Shoulder of History, to which I was privileged to do the introduction. Now, following that, on the 13th of April, which is a Saturday and Sunday, I will be at the campus at USC at the Los Angeles Times Book Fair, where I can show my book, Your Mother's Not a Virgin, The Bumpy Life and Times of the Canadian Dropout Who Changed the Face of American Television. I must tell you, it will replace Ben Hecht's A Child of the Century as the best book ever written about anyone in show business. It's not just my story, this amazing Canadian rags to American riches story. It starts off like David Copperfield and ends up like Neil Simon or Ed Murrow. It is a great read in itself, but there's scores and scores of other stories that you will love. And last night, I read 11 pages of my first album called It's Tough to Be White. A lot of the material is still topical and pertinent, and I could have never done it without the help of Red Fox and Dick Gregory. Now to my show, which I am truly looking forward to. In 1970, at the height of the Vietnam War, I was the original host of the AM show. There was a young nun in town who was very progressive and very anti-war, and nobody would put her on television except yours truly. Not only did I want to hear what a nun had to say in opposition to the war when her church was supporting it, but she wrote this fabulous little book of aphorisms called To Believe in God. And the one that I loved the most was the centerpiece, which I have hanging downstairs. It says, to believe in God is to have the deep, abiding faith that somewhere, someone is not stupid. Now, when I introduced her, I said, anybody who looks at the history of the church and religion realizes that over the centuries, the most destructive thing physically and intellectually to all humankind was the spread of religion. But even though it created all that destruction, religion created some of the greatest art, some of the greatest music, some of the greatest architecture, and some of the greatest people. And Sister Carita was one of them. Now, after 49 years, I'm going to meet another nun who is also one of them. Her name is Sister Carrie Bernore. I saw her quite by accident a week and a half ago. I was astounded by her story. First of all, I saw her on YouTube, and I must say, and I shouldn't say this about a nun or an ex-nun, she's a very attractive young woman. And she left the church because she brought sexual assault charges against the church. I believe she won that case. Then, as a victim, she created this great site called From Victim to Victor. And what she was talking about was something that I had no idea about. Not only her experiences in the church, but she was talking about the chemicals and the poisons that are in the foods we eat every day and the beverages that we drink every day. So I rushed to the phone, rushed to my producer, and I said, please, will you get Sister Carrie? And she agreed to be on the show, and I'm thrilled that she's here right now. Sister Carrie Bernard, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. And just so you know, I did lose the criminal case. I was representing the Commonwealth as a witness to what had occurred to me. And I ended up losing it. And that's what prompted me to research even further and more deeply into wider topics as to why our nation ended up getting sick and ill and how to diagnose that and so forth, to arriving to the question what you brought up regarding what's in our food, our water, and so forth. So
let's put that in reverse, because I am always fascinated, Sister Carrie, why and how people somehow end up where they end up in their lives. I mean, is it by accident? Is it planned? Now, in my case, all the wonderful things that happened to me were all accidental. All the disasters were the things I planned well. So, so start out just by telling me a little bit about your childhood. Were your parents an influence on your becoming a nun? Did you have siblings? Tell me about your early influences and what you really thought you wanted to be as a youngster.
Well, the funny thing is I grew up with Protestant sentiments. Our family was not necessarily religious practicing. We did go to church every, Christmas or Easter with Auntie Mona, our great aunt. And so we weren't really brought up or reared up in anything, but we learned to ultimately respect the scriptures or somebody, in that belief system of Christ. So it's interesting. One day, my mother was very strict, and she said, you need to go to your room right now and pray to God. So this is the beginning. This was around maybe 9 years old, if I remember correctly. Now, of course, for those who are interested in detail, like hard, stark detail, they can read the account for themselves in my book called Divine Challenge.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful.
So it's, almost 360 something pages. Bottom line is, and it's Divine Challenge, the Clergy Sex Abuse of a Hermit Nun, and it's 15-year cover-up by monastery and church officials. So basically, my mom said, and you can get that, www.clergyvictim.com. All the way down on the left side, there's going to be a tabulation for Divine Challenge, and you can find that readily there. So basically, my mom made the threat. You got to go to your room to pray. So I go in my room, and I'm earnestly looking up, and I'm like, okay, I want to pray, but the problem is if I pray to Jesus, Buddha's going to get mad. If I pray to Buddha, Allah's going to get mad at me. If I pray to Allah, Vishnu is going to destroy me. So I'm like, forget it. Somehow at 9 years old, I was very aware that there were other religions. And so I said, forget this. I'm not going to pray because I don't want to get in trouble with anyone in the heavens because I don't know who's who up there. And so I said to God, I said, whoever you are, just reveal who you are to me. And sure enough, as the Bible says, in the body, out of the body, who knows? I don't care. It's not up to me to know exactly how this happened, but it was a spiritual experience. And I encountered this Christ. And I didn't study anything historically, but yet found out years later that this truly did occur in Christ's account.
You're 9 years of age. You come out of that room. When is it that you decide that you wish to become a nun, and how old were you when you did that?
This is leading up to how that happened.
Okay.
I had direct contact with this being, Christ. He was luminous. And I said, okay, you're going to get crucified tomorrow. I got to get you out of here. And he's laughing at me. He thinks it's funny. So I said, so he gave me this look and said, basically, this is the way it's supposed to be. So I went down to touch his leg, and he had luminous clothing on, apparel, and it was white. And I recognized, oh my God, I'm touching God. And that's when it came to me, that prayer that I asked for God to reveal who he was. That's how that happened for me.
Did you say any of this to your mother? And did you feel, or did she feel, that maybe you were having some kind of hallucination?
I didn't share it with my mom, but I did write these things in a journal.
Okay. So, now, how old are you when you decide to become a nun? So
9 years old, following that instance, immediately I said, whoever that guy is, I want to marry him. That's how it calculated when I was 9 years old.
Okay. So now, bring up the word marriage. Marriage also means procreation. I'm going to... I have to touch on this because I can't help it, okay? Mark Twain would not have this published till after his death. And he says that the greatest joy that humans have is the joy of sex. But the heavens replace that by giving you a harp, which I really think is very, very funny. Well, you get to be a young teenage girl. Did you have a boyfriend?
I didn't feel sexual attraction towards people, you know, in that sense. I had this drive in my heart where I was driven towards God. So I'm considered what they say is an asexual. And I joined the AVEN Network, Asexual Visibility Education Network. And we actually have our own flag. It's purple, black, and white.
Are there a lot of such people?
There is, I think it's under 1% of the world that is asexual. Now, here's the part that because you went straight to the heart of this issue, okay? My logic as a child was, okay, I remember seeing movies about nuns when they take vows, they dress up in regalia to basically get married, like a wedding gown.
Audrey Hepburn in A Nun's Story.
The nun story. So I was like, hey, wait a minute. That's how I'm going to marry Jesus. And I wasn't Catholic. So that's logically how I tried to calculate what I wanted to do. And it was in my heart.
Well, so now, okay, Sister Carrie, how can it be a marriage if there's not going to be procreation?
Now you're getting to the good stuff. Okay.
All right. I feel like I'm making Penthouse and Playboy.
You're going to rise above that. Playboy is only a plagiarism.
Okay.
Oh, you get to the good stuff right away, don't you?
Well, I'm sorry.
No,
but it's so interesting. It's so interesting, your journey, because you were there for 14 years. You're asexual, so it doesn't bother you, but it must have bothered some of the priests who bothered you.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the root of the problem, because in my heart, my belief is that anyone who sexually abuses anybody, obviously it's because they don't have a foundation in place. There's something that either happened to them, or they're off, or they're just not in alignment with their true self. So here's the deal. We would think that Jesus, you know, is asexual, you know, and I'm not going to go down.
Wasn't he married to Mary Magdalene?
We call that the Da Vinci load of crap. Okay.
Okay.
Because I know Standard Oil of New York funded that. Okay? And I with the people in the room with Dan Brown. And bottom line is they were laughing and said, these stupid American schmucks, they're going to lose their faith over this. And they thought it was funny. I never reported.
You should be doing stand-up.
I don't know. Well, maybe.
Well, it was his name, not Joshua Ben Joseph. And didn't he have a brother called James?
Ah, now this is where we get to Adelphoi in Greek means cousin or half-brother. So when Jesus had brothers, that basically means that Joseph was an older guy. He was available, okay, so that Mary wouldn't be rushed away to be killed, because under Mosaic law, she'd have to be murdered for the adultery.
Yes, but you're talking about Greek, but wasn't the Bible originally written in Aramaic?
Yes, And so, but the what the Masoretic texts and the others, those that same word, Adelphoi, actually does talk about its half brother. I learned that from a Jewish person, actually. The Jewish one taught me about the Greek.
Okay, now I want to get you into the, did they call it a nunnery, as Hamlet refers to it, or is it a monastery? And what were your feelings once you put on the habit of the nun and got in there? Were you surprised by the beliefs or the practices or the non-beliefs or the attitudes of some of the other nuns? Tell me about that experience.
The nun, actually, when I went to the convent, that's what we were part of was a convent, St. Benedict Center, Still River, Massachusetts. Basically, it was a very, very positive experience for me. These women were awesome. They were organic farmers, really good, well-rounded people. And so bottom line is, it felt like when I donned the habit, it felt like home at last.
Oh, this was wow. Me. How sweet.
And it felt, I was totally in alignment. And so now here's the deal. You went back early and you talked about, you know, sexuality, and you're bringing out this aspect of no procreation. When a celibate person or when mysticism is not disguised sex. Sex is disguised mysticism. Sexuality points to a mystery that's greater, that's going to exist in the afterlife. Okay. So when people say, well, you join and you become a nun, you're going to get none of it. That's what they say. You're going to get none. Right. And I'm like, wait a minute, sweetheart. You can understand all that activity that goes on in the bed over there, okay, is only a foreshadow. It's a foretaste of the bliss that one's going to experience in the heavenly realms and even now in your prayer life.
Well, the French call it le petit mort, the little death.
Yes.
Because you actually cannot think at all when you're having an orgasm. Okay, I shouldn't say that to you, because maybe that's something you've never...
It's not inappropriate. That's not inappropriate. This stuff should be talked about. The more it's talked about, the better and the healthier people are going
to
be.
Oh, the only thing that I thought about, and I hate to say this, but this is the comic in me, and I don't know where it comes from. But when I heard that you were sexually assaulted, I thought, thank God there's some priests who attack women and not little boys. So when it happened to you, now I don't want you to get too graphic about this. We can do that privately on the phone, but I don't want you to get too graphic about this. But it had to be a horrifying shock to you to realize that the priest that was doing this to you was not living up to the vows that you were living up to.
Yeah, that was a shock, and that definitely threw me into a tailspin for over 7 years. But I was able to rebuild. 7 years.
Now, when you became a real nun, what was your mother's reaction? Thought, oh my God, she came out of the room at 9 years of age and now she's running off to a convent. My goodness gracious.
My mom was so relieved. She was like, she knew this was really my true self. Like this was my, at first she thought it was a fad because I loved everybody. I loved Motley Crue people. I loved the rappers, the Rastafarians, the Puerto Ricans. I used to speak to them. I loved everybody, the nerds. So my mom,
you know what, Sister Carrie, your face has a glow, and it's the glow of somebody who is really in tune with themselves, even though you said you were no longer, you still call yourself Sister Carrie, but you're not, you've divorced yourself from the church?
From the Roman Catholic Church, but I kept the good. So I kept Jesus, kept my vows with him, but I said goodbye to the institution.
Okay, now tell me how and when this assault came about, and how on earth did you keep it to yourself when so many other young boys and young women didn't, they were forced to keep it to themselves? What was it about you that started to create trouble for the Catholic Church?
Well, the 23rd of August, 2001 is when the assault took place. And it was 2 months after that or thereabouts when I visited a friend, Sister Mari Maloof in Petersham, St. Scholastica's Priory. And I sat and talked with this nun. And she told me that the same priest did the same thing to one of her friends about a decade ago, prior to my incident. And that's when the fire in me rose up and said, I cannot be quiet about this. I have to do something because obviously this wasn't a one-time deal. And if they could have proceeded further beyond a boob grab, because that's what happened, then I'm sure they would have done it. And that's when I found out several other victims of St. Joseph's Abbey were approaching me. Lawyers were approaching me to be an expert witness. And I realized it was a sex cult. A sex ring was going on at the Abbey.
Well, how on earth could you lose that case when this priest had done it 10 years earlier? And you had that...
They controlled the court verdict, and I have a lot of evidence for that. And I went into against the Board Bar of Overseers. I went and reported against Anthony Murata, who is the attorney for the Commonwealth, representing my claim. And I proved, basically, I went all the way to the Superior Court myself. I didn't study law, but I had to in order to file this document. It hit the newspapers in 2003, how Murata handled the case inappropriately. And bottom line is, that's when I realized there was something much bigger at work going on in Massachusetts, and that Massachusetts state politics was basically being run by the Vatican. And I have all the connections to that.
Sister Carrie of Arc, that's who you are. Now, the thing that startles me, here you are taking on this monstrous Catholic Church, and it seems to be crumbling, and yet it's still as strong as ever. You go from that to this unbelievable research that you do into these chemicals in our foods and our beverages. How on earth did that happen? Because it is so totally different from being religious.
It's like you said, your disasters, I guess my subconscious was creating a disaster and the law of attraction brought me to it. I don't know. I have no idea. But I think it's that God is allowing me to unravel these problems so that we can fix them. And how did it transition? Basically, what happened was when I walked away from all of this nonsense, I moved from Massachusetts after I was burnt out being a victim advocate in the private capacity. I went and I lived in Texas, realizing now that the Vatican was actually following me through agents that were hired, and I have the names of the agents that were hired to follow me while I'm living in Texas.
Wow. Okay? Wow.
People were following me, and I'm like, wait a minute. Why are they looking me up on the website? Why are all my activities being tracked? It didn't make sense to me because I thought I was minding my business and behaving in accordance with their mindset. In 2011, I had a surgery. The surgery shows the implications of 9 sophisticated targetings using a material called nanotechnology. It's a weapon. It's a military-grade weapon. I spent $400,000, and I came up with all of this evidence, and I'm going to read you only a portion of it. I'm only showing you the book so you could see the essence of the seismic quality
of
the
evidence. Gracious.
My affidavit that was sent to Donald Trump, and now he put me under protected status since December 2016.
Donald Trump did?
Absolutely.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you a question. First of all, I want you to get into talking about the business of nanotechnology, about which I know nothing, but I hear a lot about it on Jeff Rentz's side and some other very progressive people. I don't know what it is, but it seems to be making sense. So aside from that, I have to ask you this question. I know a number of very bright people like yourself who are strong supporters of President Donald J. Trump. I have never heard Donald Trump talking about nanotechnology. So why would you be so strongly supportive and hope that the truth comes out about nanotechnology from the White House when he has never talked about it?
I'm going to answer that based upon the mail I received today. Okay, so excuse me, I'm going to go to the table and grab that for you.
Okay, go get it. My
Lord have mercy. You always go to the good stuff. My goodness, you get straight away to the point. This is in regards to the Freedom of Information Act I filed with the Department of Defense, okay? On the matter of nanotechnology and what on weaponized nanotechnology. Now, we received, this is to Ms. Bernor, me. We received your Freedom of Information Act 16th January 2019, seeking all records pertaining to any programs relating to the use of nanotechnologies in foods or municipal water supplies from the years of 1st January 2013 to 16 January 2019. Your request is being processed in accordance with Title V USC. It's basically the FOIA. And it says, in pursuant to the Executive Order 13526. That's giving me a clue as to what they're going to tell me next.
Now, the question is, what exactly is nanotechnology and what's its purpose and why would it be put in food and beverages?
Okay. First, so you know, the executive order is basically the reason why Trump can't talk about it. Okay, there's a lot of the files are still classified and there's other files that were declassified. So they're going to dole out to me what they're allowed to talk about. But I can assure you that there are classified matters relating to this very situation.
Because now, I was totally, totally spellbound. I couldn't take my eyes off of you on that YouTube, which I hope people would go to watch, with you talking about nanotechnology. I do not still understand the purpose of it and why it is in foods. Is it supposedly like the stuff that they're putting in water, that the Germans put in water to calm us down?
It's worse than that. It's actually worse than GMO. It's basically for the purposes of infection and deployment of, coupling it with a signal, for instance, 5G or something like terahertz. They can cause this stuff to replicate in the body and shut down the organs over time. This is scientifically evidenced.
Why would they do that to humans when they themselves are human?
They have other ways to prevent that from happening to themselves.
Oh, my goodness gracious. So then I would ask you, as I asked once asked Joe, who I'm going to talk to later, who's a vegetarian, what it is that he eats because he is so healthy. What is it that you eat to maintain your health? What is it you would tell me not to ingest, not to eat, or not to drink?
Okay, so we don't have a label yet for no nano certifications on foods or other products yet in this country. However, I am working on a methodology for that. I go to the Tony Pantelarsko's website or on YouTube, and I prepare my food in accordance with his tools, where he teaches you how to clean out the foods from the nanotech, teaches you how to remove that. He's another pioneer on this. He's www.augmentenforce.50webs.com or something like that. So very
well. I must say you look remarkably healthy.
Well, thank you. I work very hard on that. God has healed me many times, but in addition, I support that too. Now, going back, just so you know, in particular, there's a difference between the food, the nanotechnology in the food, and the nanotechnology that I was encountering in my own experience.
I see.
This is a toxicological report written by Dr. Hildegard Stanninger, who is one of the top people dealing with the subject matter of nanotech. And bottom line, I have psychological evaluations saying I have a sound mind, that this was really real, that this did happen because of the physical evidence. She basically says in this affidavit, July of 2015, specifically in Kerry Bruner's case, it was used as a bioweapon, chemical weapon, a weapon of mass destruction with specific parameters used to give a rabbit fever, leukemia, breast cancer, and or colon cancer, and as well as to use nanosilicon CMOS MEMS neurosphere technology to violate her privacy, to damage her permanently and cause her death. And then she gets into the reasons why this happened to me in relationship to having exposed St. Joseph's Abbey through this case number back in 2013.
You say, Sister Carey, you say it's worse than GMOs. There are a lot of European countries that have outlawed GMOs. With nanotechnology in the foods that you were talking about in the YouTube, you mentioned some specific foods. What were they?
Okay, in accordance with centerforfoodsafety.org, there is a list of all the foods that have nanotech in them, or at least that which they've been able to test thus far. And I was referencing a document that I believe is truly Department of Defense, because the data in here was accurate. And that's the document I was talking about, the DOD Nano Domestic Quell Record. And in that record, they specify in 2013, under Obama's regime, that Pepsi, Nestle, Chicago Municipal, Atlanta Municipal, Danone, Coca-Cola, Los Angeles, and Seattle Municipal had liquid dispersals of nanotechnology, basically saying total infections for ages 18 and above may reach 99%. This was by January 2014. Dispersal outflows have shown a significant improvement in population infection rates. So that's why I reached out to the Department of Defense and said, listen.
Again, I have to get to why would the 1%, if this is something that's engineered by the 1%, why would the 1% be doing that to the 99%? What is the purpose of it?
Obviously, there's a genocidal backdrop to this, okay? There's a genocidal backdrop.
Are you talking about depopulation?
Yes.
Which Kissinger always talked about.
Yeah, this is part of it. This is definitely part of that plan. And just, you know, a doctor, David Bennett, who's a veteran biochemist working on a European Commission project on the ethics of nanotechnology, is quoted saying, this is regarding nanotechnology in foods. Uh-huh. Very little assessment has been done on this area regarding the detection of nanoparticles in food and labeling, even on some products already entering the market. And it's open question whether it will be done, whether they're going to detect this stuff or not and label it. The lack of proper assessment of nanotechnology scares me shitless. This is a Dr. David Bennett. Okay?
That is funny.
There's so many things. I mean, but
Sister Carrie, there are a lot of us like me. I am too lazy and not knowledgeable enough to go to a site that you would recommend to find out how to prepare my food. It's just, you know, and first of all, humans, like animals, are not designed to have three meals a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. They're designed to forage. So yep. I just forage. When I feel hungry, I get myself something to eat, and I don't want to worry about food, because I have seen two people on national television, and Joe will probably verify this later. I saw two of them on national television. One was on the Dick Cavett Show. They were both under 40 years of age. They were health food junkies their whole life. Every minute, every second of every day was about what they ate. And they died on network television. Okay, so you're not... I once had an endocrinologist telling me, John, whatever your body tells you to eat, eat it. If they tell you to eat chocolate. If they tell you to eat whipped cream, your body is telling you something. So as somebody who wants to just eat and sort of be content and not worry about nanotechnology, what would you suggest my diet be?
Okay, let's make it more simple than that.
Please. Okay?
I have a record from Russia. Now, if you want to be lazy the way I am, because I'd rather be lazy about it.
Oh, you're not lazy. I'm lazy.
I'd like to have like a lemon meringue pie or something like that every now and then and not worry about little nanobots coming into my bloodstream, you know? Yeah. So here's what I do, and I recommend it for everyone. And whether you're a believer or not doesn't matter. The point is it works. Religion News, 17 March 2006, on the website www.imdleo.gr, it's from Greece. Basically, when you go to eat food, it shows in a Russian physicist, which I can't say, Angelina Makarovskaya or something. I'm going to totally mutilate her name. She basically says this is all evidenced in Russia that... Moscow, March 17, Interfax. Scientists have proven experimentally the miracle-working properties of the sign of cross and prayer. You just say a little cross over your lemon meringue pie, and down it goes if you want to be lazy about it. That's what I do. And I still do prepare most of my foods with the other stuff, but on occasion when I'm out and I want to enjoy myself, I bless my food. It's over. It's a done deal.
Well, you are blessing yourself. I can't tell you how much I appreciate the fact you're here. And what I would like you to do is I'd like you to tell our audience and me where we can go. I think the site is called From Victim to Victor. Give us some sites that we can go to look at your wonderful YouTubes and listen further to you.
Excellent. The YouTube channel is Sister Kiri Bernor, S-I-S-T-R, Sister Kiri, K-E-R-I, Bernor, B-U-R-N-O-R. And the one you were referencing is called Ex-Nun Exposes Jesuits and Reveals Remedies. And then, you know, an urgent call to all Americans. That's the specific one I think you are watching. The other one is my website, www.clergyvictim.com. So we accept you the way you are, clergyvictim.com. But the motto is transforming victims into victors. And having been, you know, gone through so much of all this nonsense, I was able to devise a plan to reverse engineer it so other people don't have to go through what I went through, or if they are going through it, they might want to get their hands on this DVD. It's the first of its kind. I'm the first known survivor to come out with the remedy on this matter, at least that I know of. I haven't seen any evidence of it to the contrary.
I must tell you, whatever it is that you're doing seems to be working for you, because you look fantastic, you sound fantastic, you got a great smile, and you do great YouTubes. You give great YouTube. So,
thank you so much.
Anyway, I want to thank you so much. I will get your address, and I'm going to send you an autographed copy of the book, because I love your reactions to my story about how I lost my faith, and yet somehow I feel that the good fortune that has come my way was predestined. Why I feel? Because it happened that way, and I try to be as realistic about that as possible. Anyway, Sister Carrie, thank you so much for being here, and bless you.
God bless you, too. And I'll send you a copy of mine. I just need your address.
Okay, I will get it to you. Thank you, dear. You have a wonderful day and a wonderful weekend.
God bless you.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye-bye. We're going to be right back with somebody without whom I could not do the show. And I'm so anxious to talk to him because he was on the sidelines listening to Sister Carrie, who just... She could do stand-up, I'm telling you. Any nun that tells you she's scared shitless, I'm telling you, it's my kind of woman. Anyway, Joe, thank you so much for being here. And your first thoughts about Sister Carrie in the business of nanotechnology, because I know you're a vegetarian, and you eat well, and you look terrific.
Yeah, well, my vegetarianism is not motivated by nanotechnology. And, you know, my concern about nanotechnology actually has a lot more to do with its weaponization than it does its being interspersed in the food supply. Because a nanobot, for example, that could be deployed small enough to use the viscousness of the air to suspend itself so that it can get into your nose, go into your bloodstream, go into your heart, and destroy the blood vessels in your heart or your aorta. That's actually, to me, a far more likely and far more scary aspect of nanotech than what's going on in food. Because I think, you know, also you have to remember that nanotechnology at this point in time is actually still relatively expensive. So hard to disperse where... Frankly, let's be honest with you. I'll be honest with you. If somebody wanted to just engage in some kind of population culling poisoning of the food system, they've been doing it since the Green Revolution. It's called herbicides, pesticides, and fungicides.
Okay, pick that up, because that was really interesting point, because it reminds me of Rachel Carlson's book.
Yeah, Rachel Carson.
What was it called?
Silent Spring.
Silent Spring. And that book's like 40 years old, for crying out loud.
Well, Sat, you know, you mentioned at the top of the show that your album, It's Tough to Be White, right? Right? Is still relevant today, which is a sad commentary on the progress we've made as a culture when it comes to race issues. And Silent Spring is still relevant today. Now, in that case, it was about DDT, and DDT, which was widely used. I mean, you can actually go back to images, particularly post-World War II, of people being doused with DDT dust to deal with things like lice outbreaks or whatnot, just breathing in DDT. I remember there's a great cartoon, like a Warner Brothers cartoon, where they showed DDT being sprayed, and the DDT... in the cartoon stood for drop dead twice, because really what it does is it not only can kill the being who ingests it, but it actually gets into the system and ends up disrupting the reproductive capabilities, particularly in that case of birds.
That reminds me of a great cartoon I saw in the 50s of a family having a picnic outdoors in Griffith Park. And the mother is saying to the family, come and eat your soup before it gets dirty.
Right. Well, our food is incredibly dirty. It is dirty from pesticides, herbicides. Fungicides is one that's a big deal in California, where I live, because it's used on strawberries, and it's a known toxin to developmental toxin for children, and children love strawberries. And it also, when you spray the fungicide, it drifts, it gets in. So if you're in a close proximity to it, you're ingesting it. We're basically in an ongoing chemical experiment every single day. We are being inundated with these poisons. We are being inundated with plastics. We are being inundated with microplastics. You know, Sister Carrie was talking about nanotech. Frankly, I'm way more concerned with microplastics than I am with nanotech. And microplastics, which are basically being shed into our food system on a continual basis, and they are showing you can't eat fish right now without eating microplastics, because there's so much plastic in the ocean from us discarding plastic. It breaks down into these small little particulate pieces that the fish ingest. And so when you ingest the fish, you are ingesting microplastics. So I mean, it is amazing that actually we live as long as we do, considering how poisoned we are. And I do wonder if we were to actually move to more sustainable organic food processes and get rid of all of the artificial nitrate fertilizers and get rid of all the pesticides and the herbicides and the fungicides and actually get into traditional sort of biological farming.
If we got into that kind of farming, though, do you think the earth would create enough food to feed the billions of us?
I actually think it would, because in an oddity, it's actually far more sustainable over time. The Green Revolution created this spike in production, but what we are finding is we're getting to that problem of diminishing returns over time. The more that we pump chemicals into the production of food, the more chemicals we have to produce, and the more we do that, the more problems we create. You know, evolution works. So it's really funny how we spray pesticides and most of the bugs die, but not all of them, and then those bugs reproduce, then we spray again and most of the bugs die again, but not all of them, and over time they evolve to resist. The same thing is happening with weeds now. We have super weeds. We have super bugs from all the antibiotics that we pump in. Here's a good example. Cows mostly eat corn in America. Corn-fed. Oh, yes, I got corn-fed cattle. Well, that's partially because corn is a gigantic lobbying sector in Washington. Corn, big corn, has big money, and corn is prioritized. Well, cows are fed corn because there's so much corn, but cows are not designed to eat corn. So when cows are fed corn all the time, they actually get sick. They get an intestinal infection eating the corn. So what do? We pump them with antibiotics so that we can continue to feed them corn. But as we pump them with antibiotics, we are now eating meat with all these antibiotics, which is creating antibiotic resistance in the animals and in us. And we're actually getting to a point at which we don't have the antibiotics to kill the super infections that are being created in no small part by the factory farming that comes from us misfeeding cows something that they wouldn't normally eat in nature.
Oh my goodness gracious.
We're insane. And here's the other thing. If you think about the hundreds of millions of tons of food waste, you asked this question about when we would be able to feed the millions. Well, if we didn't buy all of these unhealthy foods that are created by an unhealthy factory farming process and then throw so much of it away, if we actually had a more realistic view of how we consume food, we probably could feed the millions simply by the fact we wouldn't be throwing away all this excess food that we shouldn't be eating in the first place. I mean, these are quibbles, but...
Well, it seems as though our government is run by corporations and our diet is run by corporations.
Yes.
Our health is run by corporations. I don't see, quite honestly, any force that could crush these corporations and turn them into human beings. I mean, that the Supreme Court would rule that a corporation is a person is absolutely and totally insane. It's not absurd. It is insane.
Well, I'm going to give you, there is one force. Mother Nature. I think Mother Nature, there's, you know, corporations in America run on something called externalities. This was a genius idea of Milton Friedman, who was awarded a Nobel Prize in economics, which tells you something about the veracity of the Nobel Prize even before they gave one to Obama before he ever entered office. But Milton Friedman believed that externalities, that engaging in externalities was your your moral duty as a CEO of a corporation. What an externality is if you have a way of taking the cost of creating a product and externalizing it from your bottom line, so that if I have product X and product X to make it creates all kinds of pollution, instead of actually changing the creation of product X so that it doesn't pollute the environment, I find a way to make product X in a country that doesn't regulate that pollution. I externalize the cost to the people of Mexico or China. Hey, I'm making money. I externalize the cost. But there are no externalities in nature. And that's really what I see climate change as. We've been externalizing all of this carbon pollution, saying, hey, we got a free ride. We don't have to pay the real cost of consuming all of these hydrocarbons. Uh-oh, guess what? Nature's been running the balance sheet this whole time, and she's starting to collect. It's the same thing with these antibiotic resistance. Cows are not supposed to be eat corn. We feed them corn anyways. They get sick. We give them antibiotics. Guess what nature does? Creates superbugs. And so I think that when you look at all of these illnesses that are being generated by all these externalities we've been living off of in our agriculture and our energy production, nature is basically enforcing, in a sense, market discipline by saying, no, you're as a species are going to go bankrupt because I have been keeping the tally all of these decades and I'm about to collect on it. So when you
I can give you a perfect example of nature fighting back. My wife, Sarita, is one of those very, very rare individuals who's highly allergic to alloys and chemicals.
Oh.
She could not go, if there's too much chlorine in the water, she can't go in the water, okay? She used to have to take a nap every 2 hours in the afternoon when we lived in Los Angeles, primarily because of the smog. It totally exhausted her. We moved because she was incapable of then breathing in Los Angeles, and she had developed a frog filament over her eyes. We went to an ophthalmologist, and he examined my wife's eyes, and he says, this only happens to frogs. I said, what is that? Frogs, in order to protect their eyes from the pollutants in the waters, grow a filament over their eyes. Your wife has developed frog filaments over her eyes, and I suggest you get out of Los Angeles. And so that's the main reason that we moved. My wife might be dead now if we had continued to live in Los Angeles, California, and she's a survivor of that. Now, the other thing, your news vandal today had a lot of really, truly interesting stories. Now, we're pre-taping this, and hopefully it'll be up on Monday. But for you, what were the two most interesting stories in your news vandal today?
Well, the lead story in Bloomberg about the Foxconn boondoggle that Donald Trump and Paul Ryan ushered into Wisconsin and said, oh, all these massive jobs are coming, factory jobs are coming, so we're going to give a huge tax break to this corporation to come in and build this factory. And guess what? It turns out it was a gigantic bust. They're not going to put factory jobs there. They're actually changing the whole nature of the facility they're building there. And meanwhile, they got this huge tax break. Below it was another story about an impoverished town that gave a huge set of tax breaks to U.S. Steel to come in. And this is actually happening all around the country. We had this struggle to get the new Amazon headquarters located. It finally went to New York. It looks like there's blowback against it. It's not going to go to New York because New York had to give all of these tax incentives for corporations to come. So it just shows you how completely skewed the supposed free market is, where you actually have to give corporations tax benefits to come and do something that they should be doing.
You do not have to give tax benefits to Amazon, one of the wealthiest corporations.
Exactly. That's the insanity of it. Below that, the second story, and I know Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is, you know, lights up everybody either positive or negative on a number of different issues on socialism and the New Green Deal, but she was in a congressional hearing, I think it was yesterday, which would have been Thursday, and we're taping on Friday, and this is going to go up over the weekend. But if you go to the Friday News Vandal, which is today, February the 8th, you can get it on Twitter, or you just email me at info@newsvandal.com.
Tell us what she did.
Yep. She was questioning about money in politics, And she basically laid out in 5 minutes the utter corruption of money in politics, how you as bad guy congressperson can get elected with corporate PAC money from Industry X. You can go into Congress. You can create laws about Industry X that actually affect the value of Industry X at the same time you own stock in Industry X. So the people who paid you to get into Congress, they make their money, and you can make your money. It's basically legalized insider trading and legalized corruption. And, you know, you talked about corporations being a people, Citizens United. I think people ask me, is there any hope? If there's anything that should be completely publicly funded, it should be like what, law enforcement, prisons, all right, bare minimum stuff, law enforcement, prisons, the defense business or industry. And how about all of our elections? Why are our elections not completely publicly funded? Because it is the ultimate public service.
I was just going to bring that up because evidently it says that the airwaves belong to the public when indeed they don't. They belong to six major corporations. But why is it that the politicians have to buy time on the networks when supposedly the networks belong to the people?
Well, we are so far afield. We've talked about this so many times, John, about the steps, the Reagan administration, and then the 1996 Telecommunications Act, which was the massive deregulation, which was basically a combo effort of the Republicans in the Senate and the Clinton administration, and Clinton signed it, and Al Gore was a part of shepherding that through, and basically just gave away the final little bits of the public airwaves to corporations. You know, we haven't had anything like it was when the FCC was running. You remember television in the 50s and 60s and in the 70s, X number of hours a week had to go to public service television, another X number of hours had to go to educational television. All of those things are blown to bits. And a lot of it actually has to do with the coming of cable, because what cable did is change the nature of transmission, and the airwaves slowly became irrelevant. And over time, it kind of worked in concert with the deregulatory process to basically blow away all of those blow away what became finally a fig leaf of public service and public interest and public airwaves. How we get back to that, I'm not sure, because right now we're in an environment in which most of our media is being consumed through the internet, and we have willingly walked into privately owned panopticons like Google and Facebook. And when people get upset about, well, Facebook is censoring Mr. Y and Mr. Z and Ms. A and Ms. B, the funny thing is that of course they are censoring. You know why? Because they're private corporations, and unless we do something to regulate them, they have every right to censor whoever they want, because we've turned everything over to the marketplace, including free speech.
I would like to round this out by going full circle back to Sister Carrie.
Yeah.
Since I know that you were raised quite religiously yourself, and she has maintained her beliefs, obviously, in a certain way, and is still trying to do public good, talking about nanotechnology in our foods. You, on the other hand, have blossomed in a different way, and yet you somehow seem to be, to me, equally as spiritual and as human as his Sister Carrie. Give me your thoughts about that.
Well, as you know, I was baptized Catholic, and then I became a born-again Christian in the 70s when it was really kooky. Remember, people forget that our first evangelical president was Jimmy Carter.
Yes.
Remember?
Yes.
he sinned in his heart, the famous Playboy interview. I mean, just what a wonderful guy. I became an atheist for many, many years. I think now I guess I'd be sort of broadly under agnostic. I mean, does any of us actually know anything? I mean, I don't think we... John, science cannot really even explain the force of gravity. We know what it does. We can predict what it does, but how it does and why it does, we don't know. What do we know? I will come to this. My longtime mentor and friend from instructor I had in college, who I've been friends with for 30 years, is a former Jesuit priest who left the Jesuit order because of because they were not willing to engage in free speech, which is interesting. And then he went on, lived in a matriarchal society in Palau, and he got married and became a history instructor and whatnot. That's how I got to know him. I think it comes down to one thing very simply. It's a belief in the common good. I actually do believe in the common good. I feel motivated by the common good. The sister, Carrie, is motivated. I believe it's quite obviously quite obvious that she believes in the common good. And it really comes down to something from Immanuel Kant, a famous philosopher, who had something called the categorical imperative. And it's really, in a sense, a version of the golden rule, which is at all times treat people as an end as opposed to a means to an end. And if we treated each other as an end unto themselves as opposed to a means to an end, in other words, how can I use you to get what I want as opposed to just treating you as an end unto yourself, not as a means, I think that that's what motivates a lot of love your neighbor Christians. I think it's what motivates a lot of Buddhists. I think it motivates a lot of people in the world's great religions. And it's certainly what motivates me, an idea that the common good means that I look at you as an individual human being with worth, not as a tool for me to get to profit myself.
Well, I use you to profit me. You're so smart. I love having you on the show, and I wouldn't do it without you. Thank you again for being here. Love to read your News Vandal. Tell people where they can get it.
Just go to newsvandal.com. It'll pop-up screen will come up. Sign up for it. I guarantee you, you will always find something interesting, and you'll find at least one story that you would never have found on your own.
Well, thank you so much, Joe, and we'll see you again very, very soon.
Bye-bye. Good night and good luck.
Thanks.
The dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere, sunny one so true. I love you.